Have you ever felt like we're living in a world that's just, well, fracturing? You know, these huge global challenges, climate disruption, species vanishing, chronic diseases, inequality, they often hit us as separate, overwhelming
Yeah,
problems.
totally disconnected. It's hard to see the link sometimes.
Exactly. It feels like being pulled in a thousand directions,
Yeah.
and it's really hard to see how it all fits together.
Right.
But what if these crises, these things that seem so separate, aren't actually isolated? What if they're all symptoms of something deeper? And that's pretty much the core idea of this fascinating white paper we're digging into today. It's called Reclaiming Coherence, Aligning Policy Systems and Values with the Requirements of Life.
Okay.
And it's a collaboration between Dr. Bechara Saley and, interestingly, OpenAI GPT-5, dated September 2025. It argues our whole way of doing things, our systems, have gotten profoundly disconnected from, well, the basic requirements of life.
And that's where our mission for this deep dive comes in, right? To unpack a kind of universal compass offered in the paper. It's based on the philosopher John McMurtry's framework, Life Value, onto axiology, or LVOA. Now, that might sound a bit academic.
Yeah, a bit of a mouthful.
It is, but it's actually a really powerful tool. It helps us understand this deep disconnection, but crucially, it also points towards solutions. It's about learning to see the pattern underneath all the noise, identifying a kind of core design flaw in how we've set things up.
Right. So for you, our listener, we're going to try and diagnose this sort of invisible disorder, understand how we got here, and then pivot to exploring a really different way to maybe align our economies, our institutions, even the stories we tell ourselves with what actually sustains life instead of undermining it without realizing. Sound good?
Let's do it.
Okay. So the paper paints a pretty stark picture right at the start. This idea of a world in overshoot. It feels like humanity's been accelerating like crazy for decades, right?
Yeah.
Faster markets, bigger cities,
Yeah, more stuff.
more stuff. But why does it feel so out of sync with what the planet can actually handle?
Well, it's exactly that acceleration you mentioned, but combined with a kind of fundamental blindness to limits, McMurtry points out how our planet's regenerative systems, clean air, fresh water, healthy soil, they're being used up way faster than they can possibly renew
We
themselves.
see the results everywhere.
We do. Record heat, massive storms, fertile land turning to dust because of industrial farming, coral reefs just vanishing. But it's not just environmental, is it?
No, the paper links it to us too.
Right. Our own bodies and minds, soaring rates of chronic disease, mental health crises, even while medical tech seems to be leaping forward, it's like the acceleration has turned against us, against its own host.
That's a really powerful phrase, turned against its own host.
Yeah.
And the paper introduces this concept from McMurtry, value pervasion without core. What does that actually mean in practice?
Okay, so stripping away the jargon, it means our systems, the economy, policymaking, tech design, they're constantly making choices without any real consistent reference point grounded in what keeps us alive.
Like operating in a vacuum.
Pretty much. Imagine a company maximizing profit by polluting a river. The core value there is purely financial, right? It's detached from the shared need for clean water or the health of the people downstream.
So monetary growth, like GDP, becomes a main goal.
Exactly. That becomes the overriding metric of success, even if the foundations of life, ecosystems, social bonds, our health are crumbling underneath. It's decision-making that ignores the living reality it depends on.
And from that, McMurtry draws this really crucial distinction, this split between money and life. Can you break down those two different value sequences he talks about?
Absolutely. This is really central to understanding the issue. He contrasts two basic logics. First, there's the money sequence of value. You can think of it as MM.
Money to more money.
Precisely. The main goal is simply multiplying private financial capital. Profit is the end game. Human well-being, ecological health, often just side effects or externalities to be managed, if at all. It's growth for growth's sake, financially speaking.
Okay, so what's the alternative?
That's the life sequence of value. LRM of L, AAL. Here, decisions start and end with life.
Life to life, with money in the middle.
You got it. Money and resources aren't the goal, they're tools. They exist to secure and expand life's ability to flourish. Think of that farmer with seeds analogy.
Oh, yeah, Abra used that.
Right. In a money sequence, the farmer might just sell all the seeds now for maximum profit, even if it means no harvest next year.
Short-term gain.
Exactly. But in a life sequence, the farmer plants the seeds, nurtures the soil, ensures future harvests, food security, a healthy environment. Life serves life. The difference shows you where our fundamental priorities lie.
That makes it super clear. But what's really insidious, and the paper points this out, is how our cultural stories kind of mask this whole crisis. It's not just policies, it's the narratives we live by.
Oh, definitely. McMurtry identified some really powerful ones that are so ingrained they make this life-blind system feel normal, even good.
Like,
well, take infinite growth as progress. It sounds great, right? But nothing in nature grows infinitely without limit. Unchecked growth becomes, well, cancerous.
Right.
Or freedom equals consumption. The idea that buying more stuff makes you freer, but does it? Especially if that consumption wrecks the planet or traps us in debt.
Undermines collective freedom?
Precisely. And then there's the big one. Technology will save us. Tech has amazing potential, obviously, but if we just plug new tech into the same life-blind system...
it can just accelerate the problems.
Exactly. These stories, McMurtry argued, act like cultural blinders. They stop us from seeing the huge mismatch between these tales we tell ourselves and, you know, basic biological reality.
So if these stories are blinding us and our systems are making choices that ignore life, what happens when this kind of growth just keeps going? When it becomes, well, destructive?
Yeah, what happens when growth turns against its host?
That leads us right into McMurtry's cancer metaphor, doesn't it? Which is quite something.
It is. It's stark. But he argued, our global economic system behaves a lot like a cancer within a body.
How so?
Well, think about a cancer cell. It just grows, right? Without any reference to the body's overall health. It consumes resources, ignores signals that should stop it. McMurtry saw parallels. Our economic system often prioritizes endless expansion growth for growth's sake over the health of the whole system, the biosphere, society. It invades healthy systems, turning forests, communities, even knowledge into commodities for profit. And crucially, it blocks feedback loops. It ignores the warning signs.
Wow, that's a really challenging analogy.
Yeah.
And he didn't just leave it as a metaphor, right? The paper mentions three specific markers he identified, like a diagnostic checklist for this systemic problem.
Exactly. He gave us three clear signs to look for. The first is unregulated multiplication, meaning the system demands exponential growth, more production, more consumption, higher GDP, bigger quarterly returns almost as a default setting, illogical limits, social costs. Those are externalities, right? Not core to the calculation.
Could you give an example?
Sure. Think about plastics. Global production has exploded like 200-fold since the 50s. But recycling rates are tiny, and we now have microplastics everywhere. Oceans, food, our bodies. A healthy system would adjust production based on impact. But here, growth just keeps pushing.
Okay, what's the second marker?
Invasion of life support systems. As capital needs to expand, it pushes into and commodifies things that were previously shared or public, what McMurtry called the civil commons.
Like land, water.
Exactly. Land, water, seeds, even things like education and healthcare. We see water privatization, where access suddenly depends on ability to pay, not need, or corporations patent new seeds, making farmers dependent. It's turning essential life supports into profit centers.
And the third marker, you said it was maybe the most dangerous.
Yeah, blocked feedback and systemic blindness. Healthy systems need feedback. Pain tells you to stop touching the hot stove, right? Ecological warnings should make us change course, but our dominant economic logic often filters these out or ignores them.
How did this show up?
Species are going extinct at alarming rates, but forests are still valued mainly for timber. Climate disasters get worse, yet fossil fuel subsidies often increase. Chronic diseases skyrocket, but junk food is often cheaper and easier to get than healthy food. It's like the system is deaf to its own impacts, feeding on the very things that sustain it until collapse looms.
That's a really sobering picture. And it's not just one kind of problem spreading, is it? Tabor talks about metastasis on a planetary scale. Environmental, social, cultural, all feeding each other.
That's the really critical part. They're interconnected. Environmental breakdown, climate chaos, resource depletion creates social stress. Think migration, conflict over water, rising inequality. Which then fuels cultural metastasis. Traditional knowledge gets lost, community bonds weaken, our attention gets fragmented and sold by algorithms. And the terrible feedback loop is that this weakens our collective ability to even respond to the initial environmental crisis. Our social and cultural immune systems get compromised.
It sounds like we end up measuring completely the wrong things. McMurtry called it the measure value contradiction. Like, when GDP goes up, but actual life capacity goes down, it feels absurd.
It is absurd, and it's a huge red flag about our disorientation. Think about it. An oil spill cleanup boosts GDP because money is spent. Rebuilding after a war boosts GDP.
But life got worse.
Exactly. Collective life capacity, a healthy coast, a peaceful community has been diminished. Stock markets can soar while the planet burns. We're confusing the movement of money with actual well-being. It's like watching the fuel gauge drop faster and cheering because the needle is moving while the car is actually falling apart.
Okay, so we've spent some time diagnosing this deep problem. Now, the paper shifts gears towards solutions, introducing McMurtry's framework, Life Value, onto Axiology LVOA. That sounds very academic. Can you give us a simpler version? What is LVOA, really?
Okay, yeah, let's break it down. Basically, LVOA is a compass, a universal compass. It's a way to ground our values, our ethics, our decisions, not in abstract theories or old dogmas, but in the actual real-world conditions needed for life to exist and thrive.
So, grounding value in life itself.
Precisely. The formal name unpacks it. Axiology is the study of value. Onto relates to existence or being, and life is, well, life. So it's about grounding value in the requirements and patterns of life. Why it matters is it gives us a clear, objective benchmark to evaluate everything: personal choices, company policies, global treaties.
So if it's a compass, what's its true north? What's the core principle?
That's what McMurtry called the primary axiom of value, and it's surprisingly simple, elegant even.
Lay it on us.
Okay. X is of value if and only if, and to the extent that it consists in or enables more coherently inclusive thought, feeling, and action.
Okay, unpack coherently inclusive.
Right. It means something is genuinely valuable only if it expands life's capacity to flourish. Inclusive means it supports more dimensions of life for more beings. Coherently means it does so without undermining the underlying systems that support all life. It gives us a really practical question for any decision. Does this enable more life more coherently, or does it diminish it?
That is refreshingly straightforward.
Yeah.
And from this axiom, he identifies seven universal life necessities. These are the non-negotiable foundations.
That's right. These are the things that every human, regardless of culture or location, needs to simply live and have a chance to flourish.
Let's list them.
Okay. Number one, breathable air. Two, potable water. Three, nutritive food. Four, protective shelter. Five, healthy environmental conditions, think stable climate, biodiversity. Six, caring relationships and belonging, that social fabric. And seven, meaningful participation and purpose.
Now, some of those seem obvious, like air and water, but something like meaningful participation, is that truly universal in the same way?
That's a fair question. McMurtry argues yes, because while the form might vary hugely between cultures, the underlying need for agency, for contributing, for feeling like you matter within your community is fundamental to human psychological well-being everywhere. If any of these seven are systemically denied, life itself contracts. They're interdependent prerequisites for flourishing.
This really highlights the difference between what the paper calls life capital and just financial capital. The metaphor used is financial capital is the fuel gauge, life capital is the car. I think a lot of us feel that obsession with the gauge.
While the engine is sputtering, yeah, it's a perfect analogy. Life capital is the real stuff: fertile soil, clean rivers, strong communities, public health, knowledge, biodiversity, all the tangible things that actually enable life.
And financial capital.
It's the abstract representation: money, stocks, bonds. It's only valuable if it can actually support or be converted into life capital.
Yeah.
Our problem is we fixated on the symbol, the gauge, while running down the actual vehicle, the life support systems. We mistook the map for the territory.
It's easy to get a bit down hearing the diagnosis, but the paper does point to stories of life-centered coherence already happening, places like Costa Rica, Bhutan. What makes them different? What makes them genuinely life coherent?
Well, what they share is a conscious choice to prioritize life capital. Costa Rica getting almost all its electricity from renewables. That came from valuing its rivers and geothermal potential as core life assets, not just things to exploit for quick cash.
And Bhutan's gross national happiness.
Right. They deliberately look beyond GDP, evaluating policies based on well-being, mental health, cultural vitality, environmental protection.
Right.
And think about indigenous land stewardship practices that have sustained ecosystems for centuries. That's the life sequence deeply embedded in culture. They show this isn't just theory, it's possible.
Building on that idea of shared foundations, the paper talks about the civil commons. What exactly are they?
Think of them as the invisible scaffolding holding up our collective well-being. There are systems we create together to ensure universal access to life necessities. Things like public education, healthcare systems, parks, libraries, clean air and water regulations, basic legal rights, even cultural archives.
And they're different from private goods because?
Because they're generally non-excludable, designed to benefit everyone, not just those who can pay, and they allocate resources based on need, not just purchasing power. You can't really sustain a society purely on private transactions. You need these shared foundations.
They sound vital, but the argument is they're being eroded, quietly disappearing.
Yeah, that's the concern. Two main forces are chipping away at them. First, privatization, selling off public infrastructure, water systems, hospitals, schools to private companies.
Which often means?
Often means access becomes based on ability to pay, costs go up, service might decline if profit is the main motive. Think medical debt in the U.S. or struggles over water access in places where it's been privatized.
And the second force?
Commodification. This is subtler. It's when even things that remain notionally public start operating according to market logic. Education becomes just about job training for private gain, not broader citizenship. Healthcare becomes a managed service focused on cost cutting. Even social media turns relationships into data points to be monetized.
Feels like the safety nets are fraying.
That's a good way to put it. Basic needs start feeling like luxuries, and those shared systems we rely on become less reliable, more conditional.
McMurtry used another powerful analogy here, comparing the commons to our collective immune system. What's the idea there?
It's brilliant, actually. Just like our body's immune system fights off disease, the civil commons defends society from systemic harms. Environmental laws protect against pollution. Public health agencies guard against pandemics. Labor laws protect workers. Libraries protect access to information. There are collective defenses.
And the COVID-19 pandemic really highlighted this.
Absolutely. It was a stark test. Countries with strong public health systems, universal healthcare access, better social safety nets, essentially, robust civil commons, generally managed the crisis far better and more equitably than those where those systems had been weakened or privatized. It showed that resilience is fundamentally collective.
So if we want to rebuild to design systems that actually work for life, we need to be careful not to fall into old traps. The paper talks about naming the blind spots in many current solutions.
Right. A lot of things that sound good on the surface can still be stuck in that old money sequence logic.
Like?
Well, greenwashing is a classic. Companies making big environmental claims but not changing their fundamental business model. Or technological salvationism, the idea that some magic invention will fix everything without changing the underlying economic system that drives the problem. Often, new tech deployed in a profit-first way just creates new problems or deepens inequality.
Even just sticking with GDP is the main measure of success.
That's a huge blind spot. We keep measuring the wrong thing. These solutions often fail because they inherit the core problem, prioritizing financial metrics over life support systems. Real regeneration needs a deeper shift.
Okay, so what does a truly life-coherent economy look like? What are its core operating principles?
The paper lays out four key principles. First, and most fundamental, life first. Every major decision policy, investment design gets tested against that basic question. Does this sustain or enhance the conditions for life to flourish coherently?
Simple but radical. What's next?
Second, regenerative cycles over linear extraction. Moving away from the take-make-waste model. Designing economies that mimic nature, closing loops, reusing materials, regenerating ecosystems. Think of circular economy initiatives like Amsterdam aiming to have resource use.
Makes sense.
Third, civil commons as the organizing architecture. Instead of eroding them, we need to actively strengthen them. Robust universal healthcare, public stewardship of essential resources like water, open access to knowledge and information, these become the foundation.
And finally,
fourth, life-centered metrics. We have to measure what actually matters. Moving beyond GDP to indicators like the Genuine Progress Indicator, GPI, Kate Raworth's Donut Economics Framework, or Bhutan's gross national happiness, measuring well-being, ecological health, social equity directly.
Those principles are clear. But translating them into action, what kind of policies or institutional changes are we talking about?
Some pretty bold shifts are needed. Things like public banking and sovereign monetary policy, basically taking back control over money creation and directing it towards life-serving investments, renewable energy, social housing, ecosystem restoration like some community banks in Germany do.
What else?
We need ecological thresholds in economic planning. Actually building planetary boundaries like carbon budgets or biodiversity targets into economic rules, not just treating them as optional extras. mandating limits.
Huh.
Also, universal basic capacities, guaranteeing everyone access to the essentials, food, housing, education, healthcare as fundamental rights, ensuring that base level of security needed for participation and flourishing.
And technology.
Treating open knowledge and technology as commons, ensuring that essential innovations, especially those funded publicly, are shared widely as tools for collective benefit, not locked up purely for private profit.
These aren't just abstract ideas, though. The paper mentions real-world examples of regenerative design in action. What makes them truly regenerative, not just green?
What sets them apart is that shift in fundamental value. Costa Rica restoring its forests while running on renewables that's actively rebuilding life capital. New Zealand's well-being budget isn't just tweaking spending, it's changing the goal of the budget towards well-being indicators.
And indigenous practices.
Indigenous fire stewardship in Australia, for instance, now being recognized and reintegrated, isn't just about preventing megafires. It's about deep ecological understanding and participating with the ecosystem over millennia. These examples show a systemic redesign oriented towards life, which naturally brings up the question, how do we weave meaning and agency back into all this?
Yeah, that leads us to what the paper calls the forgotten dimension of change, the crisis of meaning.
How does that connect? When our systems fragment us from each other, from nature, from a sense of purpose, it creates this inner emptiness, right? And that emptiness actually mirrors the life-blind logic of the external systems. McMurtry argued that our shared stories, our cultural narratives, act like a social immune system.
How so?
They help us distinguish what's healthy from what's harmful. They inspire care, connection, responsibility. When those narratives weaken or become toxic, focusing only on individual gain or division, the whole society becomes more vulnerable to break down, just like a weakened immune system. Rebuilding meaning isn't just a nice to have, it's critical infrastructure.
That's profound. It connects to another idea in the paper, healing the inner-outer split. What's that about? It sounds like it goes beyond just policy.
It does. We often act as if the outer world, the economy, technology, is separate from our inner experience, and that our feelings or sense of purpose are purely private matters.
But they're connected.
Deeply. The systems we live in shape our inner lives profoundly. Extractive, alienating systems breed anxiety, disconnection. But systems designed with a life-coherent compass, ones that foster meaningful work, ecological connection, strong communities, they nourish both inner well-being and outer resilience. Healing that split is about recognizing the feedback loop.
But with all these huge systemic issues, it's so easy to feel, well, powerless. Mm-hmm. Like, what can one person possibly do? How do we start reclaiming agency?
That feeling of powerlessness is often part of the design, isn't it? Concentrated economic power, narratives telling us we're just consumers, algorithms shaping our choices.
Right.
Reclaiming agency starts by recognizing that and then deliberately stepping out of just the consumer role. Seeing ourselves as citizens, as community members, as potential custodians, as co-creators of the culture and the systems. It's remembering we have collective power, even when it feels diminished.
That idea of custodians leads to a really fundamental shift the paper talks about, becoming custodians of the living world, moving beyond just being tenants or extractors. What does that actually look like?
It's kind of a maturation step for humanity, maybe. Custodianship means seeing the planet not as a pile of resources, but as a living, interdependent system that we're part of.
Not separate from nature, but within it.
Exactly. And then designing our own systems, our cities, our farms, our economies, as extensions of the planet's regenerative cycles, not disruptions to them. Day to day, it means valuing a thriving forest more than the short-term profit from clear-cutting it, designing things to last, to be repaired, to nourish the soil. It's about integrating that deep ecological wisdom found in many indigenous traditions with modern understanding. Progress becomes about participating wisely in life's creativity.
So ultimately, this isn't just about policy tweaks. It's about weaving a new cultural story, one based on interdependence, sufficiency, regeneration.
That's got to be the foundation, a story that celebrates connection, not just competition, that understands enough is a form of wealth. That defines living well as contributing to the health of the whole for generations to come. It's a story where thriving together with each other and the planet is the ultimate goal. These aren't just fuzzy ideals. They're practical design principles grounded in that primary axiom of value.
Okay. So we've covered a lot in this deep dive. We've explored how this feeling of a polycrisis might actually stem from one deep issue. Our systems being disconnected from the basic requirements of life. Mm. And McMurtry's framework, LVOA, really emerges as this potential universal compass to help us reorient ourselves in what feels like a really pivotal time.
It really does. And connecting it all, that core distinction between the money sequence and the life sequence that helps us see why the current path is unsustainable. Rebuilding the civil commons, using life-centered ways to measure progress, consciously choosing regenerative pathways, and yes, reweaving that cultural story of meaning and connection. It really feels like choosing coherence over potential collapse.
Which brings it back to us, to you listening. This is really an invitation to agency.
Yeah.
Every decision we make, whether it's personal or in our work or as citizens, becomes an opportunity to ask that simple yet profound living question. Does this sustain and enrich the conditions of life, or does it diminish them?
That's the compass point.
So just imagine for a moment a world where clean air and water are truly secured for everyone now and in the future, where our economies actually work with nature's cycles, not against them, where things like education and healthcare are treated as fundamental rights, true commons, where our culture celebrates connection and stewardship.
It's not some impossible dream.
No. The paper argues its coherence. It's what a civilization organized around the actual requirements of life looks like. The choice, it seems, is ours. The compass is there. And the work, well, it begins now.